Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead a happier and more meaningful life by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts, because we could all use a little more Mindspace. So, incredibly exciting episode today. I had the enormous privilege of interviewing Mathieu Ricard, who is arguably the most well-known guest I've had on the podcast so far. For those of you that don't know Mathieu, he is a French Buddhist monk and a best-selling author. He's sometimes referred to as the happiest man in the world. And this is because in the year 2000, his brain was scanned in an imaging study, and he exhibited never-before-seen activation in certain parts of his brain, and that landed him the nickname. But in my view, what's even more interesting about Mathieu is his background. He got a PhD in molecular genetics in 1972 in his native France. And instead of going on to a successful academic career like his father, philosopher Jean-François Revel, he decided to move to Nepal and become a Buddhist monk, dedicating his life to training his mind and making the world a better place. He's been there ever since. So he has a truly unique perspective on health and well-being. There's literally no other human being on the planet who better understands the intersection of contemplative practice and contemporary science. And he brings this perspective to a variety of work activities, including contributing to scientific research on meditation, writing books, translating ancient Buddhist texts, and public speaking around the world. He also happens to be the Dalai Lama's French interpreter and close friend. Mathieu is also highly active as a humanitarian. In the year 2000, he created Karuna Shechen, an organization providing primary health care and education and social services for the underserved populations of India, Nepal, and Tibet. And all of the proceeds of his books, his photographs, and events are donated to this cause. Really cool to announce that you can actually see Mathieu speak live in Montreal later this month. So Karuna Canada, which is the Canadian chapter of his organization, is putting on a conference and a concert on April 13th at the Maison Symphonique of Place des Arts. The event is called Taking Care of Life. It will be in French, and the details can be found at karunacanada.org. So that should be a very cool event, and you will probably see me there. A couple of other quick notes about this episode before we get to it. Number one, the sound quality is pretty bad. This is because when we spoke, Mathieu was actually visiting his mother in the French countryside, and the only connection we had was through a landline. So what you're hearing is actually a direct recording of that phone call. So we did our best to clean it up in the post-production phase, and this is the best we could do. So hopefully it's not too much of an obstacle for you. Second, because this was an unusual and interesting moment, an interview, I decided to play the audio of the entire phone call, including the initial introduction and setup of the interview. Now, that part was done in French, and then we did transition to English for the actual interview. So if you don't understand French, don't worry about it. This is a very brief exchange, and then we switch into English for the interview. And finally, if you'd like to learn about meditation, deepen an existing meditation practice, or learn more about how you might integrate mindfulness into your organization, please check out our programming at mindspacewellbeing.com or presencemeditation.ca. Now, as for the interview itself, it is relatively brief, but I do feel we covered some very interesting ground, including his perspective on the explosion of mindfulness in the West in the last 20 years, developments in the science of meditation, what strikes Mathieu most when he visits Western countries, and his advice for people who want to cultivate a happier life. And now, without further delay, I bring you my interview with Mathieu Ricard.
Mm-hmm. Allô?
Bonjour, Monsieur Ricard.
Oui, bonjour.
Bonjour, ça va très bien et vous?
Ça va parfaitement.
Est-ce que vous êtes confortable? Vous êtes prête pour...
Oui, je suis très bien. Et vous voulez parler en anglais?
Si ça vous dérange pas.
Ok, c'est bon.
Super. Et encore une fois, merci de trouver le temps pour ça. C'est vraiment intéressant, vraiment très belle opportunité pour moi et mon communauté ici. Alors, je vous remercie vraiment.
So we can switch to English.
Okay, very good, very good. Okay, so my first question is that I've been practicing meditation myself for about 20 years, and I've been really blown away, even kind of shocked by how much mindfulness meditation has exploded in Western culture. And you, of course, have a much richer and a deeper relationship with this practice. I'm just curious to hear from you. What is it like from your perspective to see how meditation has really moved into the mainstream in Western culture?
Well, first of all, I think it's nice to not define sort of put meditation in context. You know, in Sanskrit, bhavana means to cultivate something. And in Tibetan, gom means to become familiar with something. So you could cultivate focused attention, compassion, benevolence, inner balance, and you could become familiar with the thought process, the fundamental nature of mind behind the screen of thought. So there's a lot of things you could become familiar with. And so roughly it's sort of mind training. And, you know, the whole Buddhist path is about getting rid of the causes of suffering. And the causes of suffering, of course, some are obvious, like hatred and craving and so forth. Some are less obvious, which is like a distortion of reality, for which wisdom is the only remedy. So familiarization is also familiarization with a correct understanding of reality. It's much more vast than what usually people call meditation, and even faster than the technical definition of mindfulness, which of course there are quite a few, but basically is to pay attention undistractedly to the present moment in a non-judgmental way and notice whatever happens without losing that mindfulness. We call that attentive presence in Buddhism. It's not quite non-judgmental because it's connected with an evaluation of whether what you notice in the present moment is wholesome and unwholesome, not in a kind of moralistic way, but in the terms of whether it brings suffering or freedom from suffering, but more in a practical way. And therefore, if something that brings suffering is undesirable. So the other aspect of being mindful of is what could be the antidote, say, to hatred, and then put the antidote in action in a proper way. So then, you know, put in this context, it's of course much faster. And then even that is put in the vaster scope of a very rich array of methods, which constitute the path from suffering to freedom from suffering, which is extremely vast. There's a philosophical aspect, an analytical aspect, practical aspect, and so forth. So now, of course, when my dear friend John Kabat-Zinn got the idea that there was a lot of suffering, especially in the medical world, from patients, from caregivers, and he was wondering how to use some of the techniques that he had learned, mostly in Burma and other places, to Buddhist practices in a way that could be acceptable. 30 years ago in a medical setting, which was not very open to the idea of bringing some weird exotic practices. So the idea of stress being one of the main factors, and mindfulness being able to reduce the stress, was already a kind of threat of genius. And recently I witnessed John reviewing 30 years of expansion of the impact of mindfulness on healthcare, and then in other fields of life, and it was truly moving and amazing. So this being said, it's never pretended to be the essence of Buddhism. I think John clearly says also it's inspired by Buddhism, but it's not an integral Buddhist practice. The only problem would be for those people who say, oh, that's the essence of Buddhism, that's much too simplistic, obviously. And also, One issue might be that if it comes out of the medical world, which it has done now in big way, going to corporate world, you might worry that it might be used in an instrumental way to make people more efficient, productive, and while remaining less stressed. I don't think this has materialized as a genuine cause of concern. Nevertheless, if when John and his team and later on many others have done that in a medical context, then of course they were there with a compassionate attitude to reduce suffering. So to make sure that, you know, this is not disembodied from that compassion or what John Kabat-Zinn called heartfulness, I believe that instead of having two things, you know, mindfulness, heartfulness, if you just speak of caring mindfulness, then you cannot go astray into a sort of cold pool to just be more attentive for whatever instrumental purpose that could be completely devoid of ethics and compassion. So meditation is vaster than that. Buddhist path is faster than meditation, but there's nothing wrong with this mindfulness revolution, which has done tremendous good throughout the world.
What do you think the risk is of using mindfulness instrumentally?
I worry about that, but then a friend of mine, a French guy called Sébastien Henry, I think his book is in English also, he interviewed 100 CEOs who had decided to incorporate mindfulness in their at their workplace. And it was very interesting because first they hesitated because they said, oh, maybe people would become less motivated, I mean, more soft, and then it's a waste of time. Maybe they would use too much time. But then what they found is actually something quite different. They found that there was two main advantages, which was not just to make people more efficient. That's not what happened. The two advantages were having better judgment because they saw things in a bigger sort of way, bigger perspective, from different perspective. And then second thing was improving of human relationship in the enterprise. So those two things are, of course, much welcome. So far, I mean, of course, I'm not a specialist because I don't work in the corporate world, but I haven't heard much of someone say, oh, look, in this company, they just use that to relentlessly push people harder and use the mindfulness to make them less stressed while pushing them like crazy. So this worry didn't happen. But I think since compassion and care is such an important thing, personally, my humble suggestion would be to always speak of caring mindfulness. So then at least you always put compassion and loving kindness in the forefront. And many studies right now put more and more emphasis on the benefit of practicing compassion and loving kindness. Mm-hmm. To the extent that Denjimba, who is also in Canada and who is the president or the chairman of Mind and Life Institute, I remember we were together in Singapore presenting the work of Mind and Life, and he said after the mindfulness revolution, now maybe we're heading to the compassion revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be great.
I wanted to talk about the science because, of course, that's one of the reasons why mindfulness has grown so much in the West. And, of course, you've been a really important figure in advancing the science. I'm curious, how do you think science in general is doing? How much progress is it making in understanding the Buddhist wisdom around well-being and the reduction of suffering?
So, you know, although I've participated in a lot of studies as collaborator, co-author, guinea pig, everything, I'm not practicing mindfulness in the technical way it is done in MBSR. So decided that initially with Francisco Varela, then Richard Davidson and Antoine Lutz, and later with Tanya Singer and Stephen Lawrence, who is one of the world specialists on consciousness, to focus, to simplify things, because there are so many kinds of meditation. And when you speak of meditation, it's like mind training. So you could train your mind in so many things. It's like physical training. You know, what are you doing? You know, football or volleyball or chess, you know, is different. So we decided that there was three types of traditional meditation that could be useful to society. and usable in a secular context. And one was, of course, focused attention. That's probably the closest to mindfulness. The other one was compassion or altruistic love. And the third one is what we call open presence, which is roughly defined as a very open, vast, vivid state, which is in our, taxonomy is somehow deeper than mindfulness because it's resting also in the deepest nature of mind. So those three have been extensively studied. They have different signature in the brain. There's no doubt that they do change the brain functionally and structurally. So that's one of the many studies I've been involved with those labs. And they are mostly about fundamental research. While mindfulness has been studied a lot in a clinical context to see what sort of good effect they could have on health, which they have. And so that field is a lot of studies. I think John Kabat-Zinn showed that, 20 years ago, there was 4 or 5 publications every year, and I think now it's 400. So, but what I've been involved in for fundamental research on different types of meditation. And then at a later stage, recently, I've been involved in a vast European study on aging and whether meditation will slow down the aging process, which a part of study done on long-term meditators show that definitely it seems that long-term meditators have structurally and metabolically a younger brain, sometimes about 10 to 15 years than the average. And also I've been involved in study on the different levels of consciousness, of vividness, of clarity with Stephen Lawrence. And also with Tanya Singer, we did quite a few, I think, groundbreaking study to distinguish empathy from compassion and show that when people speak of compassion fatigue, it's not the right term. You should speak of empathy fatigue or sort of emotional exhaustion that leads to burnout. But that compassion, at the opposite, is more like an antidote to burnout and is something that replenishes your strength and courage, while if you empathic resonance with suffering overburden you and overwhelms you as the suffering of others is repeated. So all these have been fascinating collaborations. And to show also that the meditator is not just a guinea pig, but a co-conceiver of the protocols. So they asked me to co-sign the paper, although I'm not involved in crunching the data. But because we sort of established the protocol together, so they thought it's important to acknowledge that the meditators have an active role in the research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that as well. You've got this really unique setup where I believe part of the year you're living as a monastic in Nepal and part of the year you're living Western in a Western culture in France. What is it like to go back and forth between these two contexts?
Well, yes and no, because I only spend a few days in Paris, even though usually what happens when I'm there, I do a lot of public things and media and stuff because of the books and all these things. But I increasingly spend more time either in my hermitage in Nepal or looking after humanitarian projects. Our organization, Karuna Sechen, which actually organizes the next event in Montreal in April, the Journée Emergence, now helps 250,000 people every year in India, Nepal, and Tibet. And so I'm very much involved in that. I started this organization. So, and then in France, I'm mostly staying with my 95 years old mother in the countryside, and my teachers are here, or some of my teachers are here. Even though I make a little noise when I go to Paris because the media always want to ask you things. But in fact, I don't spend much time immersed in city life and in modern way of life.
Okay, so in the moments where you are, let's say, speaking to the media or exposed to urban life, even for short periods, what jumps out at you the most as sort of different or unusual or even problematic about our lifestyle?
Well, I'm a part of the world, and of course, as a former scientist, I've been doing passionate research, especially about the question of the need for more altruism and cooperation for our time. I'm very much involved with the environment scientists. So I'm involved in too many things, in fact. Well, it's quite clear that the main challenge for the 21st century is climate change and the degradation of the ecosystem, the dramatic loss of biodiversity and of the population of living species on Earth. And that could jeopardize every other progress that has been done in a vast way over the last two centuries. So, well, I'm concerned by that, obviously, because if you think that altruism is the best solution to those challenges, then you cannot but not be deeply concerned by the fate of future generations and of 8 million other species who are co-citizens on this Earth. So concerned, definitely, I'm so deeply concerned. Now, whatever I can do is not very much, but at least participating in the debate, writing books, having a little voice here and there, having sometime, gone to weird places like the World Economic Forum or the UN to speak about those things. So whatever, I can. But if I was just on my own, of course, it's like zero influence. But together with many people coming from many fields of life, whether they are environment scientists or policy makers or economists that more emphasizes on caring economics, and all kinds of people who really want to try to build a better world, even despite this incredible challenge that we are facing. So I'm just part of this community and do my best to contribute, even modestly, to bring some cultural change. I don't know where it will lead, but we're trying our best.
So we have...
To answer your question.
Yeah.
But clearly, there's a big problem with the society of consumerism. If you think that the North American U.S. citizen, average U.S. citizen, emits 200 times more CO2 than a Zambian, but the citizen of Qatar emits 2,000 times more CO2 than an Afghani, so there's a problem there. And so it's not so much that we should prevent, say, the poor countries who have access to a minimum of energy, hopefully renewable energy, to have access to education and health and so forth, is simply that the rich countries should just stop that crazy overconsumption, which they don't seem to be ready to do. And they think that they can't be happy having less, but in fact, it's just rather the opposite. And voluntary simplicity is one of the sources of great happiness and freedom. But so that's what I think the main sort of blindness of modern society is, this constant drive for consumerism, for all kinds of things, which doesn't bring happiness. It has been shown over and again. It's not just a moralistic Buddhist view. Study like people like Tim Kasser, who did a 20-year study on the effect of consumerism. He has a very interesting book called The High Price of Materialism. Actually, it simply doesn't make people happier. They are less happy, they are less healthy, they have less good, genuine friends, they are less concerned by global issues, they are less empathetic. Yes, so this kind of drive is not good for anybody. So that's so regrettable, but I don't know how much people are ready to give it up. They think they will be less happy, they will be deprived of something good, while it's just simplification brings such a freedom. No house, no car, no land, no nothing. I'm so happy like that. Dread to have to take care of all those crazy things.
That's one of the things that has inspired me about your work, is this really interesting possibility that there are actions that we could take, simplicity, cutting down on consumerism, that are both good for the planet, good for our communities, and ultimately enhancing of our own well-being. How do you see those things? How do those things fit together?
Stop eating meat. It's so easy. Take 5 seconds. And this will be one of the factors which will be one of the easiest things to do to palliate climate change. And the latest report of the IPCC said if we keep on increasing just the factor of increasing meat consumption, that alone will forbid us to stay below 2 degrees Celsius of warming. That simple thing is the second industrial farming and crop cattle raising for meat is the second cause of greenhouse gas emission. The second one, because of the methane and all those stuff. This is crazy. I mean, it could be so easy to change that. It just takes a little decision. It doesn't mean that you change drastically other things of way of life. There's so many things like that that we could do.
But isn't it the case that some of these things that we could take not only would have a positive impact on the world, but it would also make us happier, like investing in relationships? And
yeah, but that's the, the Buddhist is very clear about that. We wish for happiness, but on our back to the cause of happiness. We don't want to suffer, but we run toward the cause of suffering. This is one of the main Buddhist statements. And even I had a Buddhist teacher who said, what you call happiness here, we call it suffering. Hmm. That was a pretty terse statement.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean exactly? What did he mean by that?
It means that when people look for happiness in, you know, remaining young forever, wealth, power, fame, rank in society, extracting value, the latest fashionable clothes, the latest model of this and that, the latest car, having a flashy home with lot of staff, and then adding to that the endless succession of pleasurable experiences, which are more like a recipe for exhaustion. So you add all that together, you are completely fooled by this kind of looking for happiness totally in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. So no surprise, that's called lack of discernment or ignorance. So that's it. No, those things simply don't bring genuine lasting happiness or fulfillment or contentment.
Where should people be looking for happiness and contentment? Or not looking at all?
Well, I mean, I try to write a book about that. First, distinguish that happiness is not the same thing as just pleasant sensation. It's a way of being, and that it's not just one thing, of course. It comes with a cluster of qualities like inner freedom, inner peace, inner strength, compassion, altruistic love, not an overinflated sort of sense of ego, not excessive self-centeredness. There's all kinds of basic human qualities. And the good news is all those can be cultivated as skills. And that's where also, mind training and neuroplasticity comes into picture. So when all those are being brought to their optimal point, then you have a fulfilled life, a sense of resilience, of strength, of inner freedom. You have the inner resources to deal with ups and downs of life. So there's nothing to do with the perpetual seeking of pleasant sensation, which simply also doesn't work. There's nothing wrong with pleasure, but it's simply not the same thing as a chance of deep fulfillment. Mm-hmm.
So what we're up against here is a challenge of educating people to change their behavior.
At the end, you start writing books, or hopefully with the hope that you will gather enough scientific and philosophical and experiential evidence. And then, it's just a little drop in the ocean that all together with many other trends of ideas and thought makes our culture. So culture are shifting with time. So let's see what will come up. Is it a more cooperative, altruistic, happier society? Or will we continue to go toward the narcissistic epidemics like it is we can see in North America? So I don't know. Let's see.
I'm very aware of the, proliferation of good science and, good books and persuasive arguments like the work you're doing. But there's also a terrible rise of partisanship and difficulty understanding the other side of debates. This is partly due to the rise of social media. What is your take on that as an obstacle to improving?
Yeah, it is a contrary force. That's well known. So again, I don't know which one will win over. Mm-hmm. I'm not clairvoyant. You can see those forces at play. And I think the main research work I did is the book on altruism. And I had to explore those antagonist forces, because otherwise it would have been naive just to say that altruism is the solution, that it exists, that we can enhance it, and that's it. But of course there are so many things, like the cause of violence, what makes us a psychopath, how can we commit genocide, how can we make wholesale massacres of animals, all these things. And then what are the solutions? To education, to going to a sustainable harmony, to more caring economics, to global governance. So, you know, this is a huge bulk of reflections upon all those issues. I tried to myself, along with many other friends, spent many years trying to formulate all those things and analyze them. So I sort of have done what I could. Now I'm a bit old and I want to go back to contemplative life. Mm-hmm. I'm not much to add, you know. I sort of did my best with my humble, limited capacity on the subject that I felt really important. And I think now it's time to move to something else.
Well, I think I can speak for my listeners and for myself that we hope you keep going as much as you can, because I think you're doing some really important work. We do have an opportunity here with the people that are listening. If there is one thing that you would like to ask people to do, or one suggestion for how people might begin to both improve the world around them and cultivate their own well-being, what would you advise people to do?
Well, it's very simple. On a personal level, cultivate loving kindness, compassion, benevolence. And on the global level, feel a sense of global universal responsibility. And no, don't stop your close ones, but extend the circle to all sentient beings and even to future generations. So if we thus expand the scope and the circle of our sort of compassion, then I think that's the best way we could go, both ourselves and for society. So I think it's altruism or altruistic love or whatever you call it, is the twofold accomplishment of others' good and your own good. And it's the only way to reconcile the immediate needs, you know, to fulfill one's needs for survival and so forth, through cooperation, kindness, and so forth. The mid-term needs of flourishing in life, and the long-term needs of caring for the future generation, for other species, for the planet. Because competition and selfishness will not do the job. So if we realize that from the intellect and from the heart, and then I think if we can cultivate is compassion in our own life, that's the very best thing we could do, both for ourselves and for others.
Thank you very much for saying that, and I really appreciate the message, and I hope our listeners do as well. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that you feel we didn't cover?
Yes, in this spirit, I think in next April we are trying to organize a beautiful meeting in Montreal on the subject of taking care of life. And so we'll have people of all walks of life, including neuroscientists. We have a witness who spent 15 years as inspector in slaughterhouses. And we have a wonderful artist like Maria Jo Pires, a great pianist. We have Alexandre Joliat, who is a Swiss handicapped philosopher, with whom I did a book called In Search of Wisdom. So I think this kind of event bringing really, really, and also a lot of people from Canada, like Remy Tremblay and others, to bring this kind of idea to a live audience as part of our service and try to, you know, to be part of that cultural change and hopefully a little bit towards a better world.
And I will definitely make all the information about that event available on the show notes for this episode.
Also, the proceeds of all that will go to our Karuna Sechen humanitarian projects in Asia. So it's like, again, also it's like the twofold fulfillment of one's own aspiration and that of others.
Okay, well, once again, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been great, and I can't wait to see you in Montreal.
Okay, take care.
Okay, you bye-bye. Too. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. The purpose of this project is to inspire people to cultivate well-being. The science tells us that well-being is best understood as a series of skills and habits that can be learned and practiced. And I hope listening to these episodes helps you move forward on your own path to well-being. If you enjoy listening to the Mindspace podcast, please share your favorite episodes with friends, family, and colleagues. Thanks a lot.